You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 617. Life sucks, but in a beautiful kind of way. Axl Rose.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Jambox.io. Now, being in post-production for almost 30 years at this point, I've used many music services over the years. But I have to tell you that Jambox is easily the best music platform I have ever used. Not only is it super easy to find music, but the quality of the music is outstanding. Jambox works with some of the biggest music composers in Hollywood. They've worked with directors like Michael Bay and Martin Scorsese. And they have over 6,000 unique tracks and tens of thousands of stems and over 10,000 sound effects. I couldn't recommend a better music resource on the internet today. And the plans are super affordable, and you can ramp up or ramp down depending on the project you're working on. So I recommend you head over to jambox.io and use the coupon code HUSTLE20 to get 20% off. That's jambox.io. Today's show is also sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success.
The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Well, guys, I am so excited to bring you today's episode. We have on the show returning champion, Sasha Gervasi. Now, Sasha's known for being an excellent writer. He wrote the Spielberg movie, The Terminal. He wrote and directed Hitchcock. He worked on his film, My Dinner with Hervé, and he's even working on The Crown right now as a writer. But honestly, what's going to be on Sasha's gravestone is the movie we're about to talk about in this episode. It's called Anvil, The Story of Anvil. And the story of how this movie came to life 13 years ago was pretty remarkable, but what has happened to it since is in more insane story. I'm not going to tell you what the movie is about. We're going to talk about all about that in this conversation, but it is being re-released as if it had never been released before. Something I've never seen before in the history of movies, honestly. They are approaching the release of this film like it had never been released. There's nothing even saying the re-release, nothing. It is just being shown as a brand new movie. 13 years later, they've got billboards on Sunset Boulevard. They've got posters on the side of buildings in Los Angeles. It is insane. And I had a very small part in making this all come to pass. And we'll talk all about that in the show. But there is going to be a special LA premiere of Anvil, The Story of Anvil, where there's going to be a Q&A. The stars are going to be there. There's going to be a ton of celebrities and directors, and I am going to be there as well. And we're giving away 2 free tickets to the LA premiere of Anvil, The Story of Anvil. So stay tuned to the end of this episode to find out how you can win these 2 coveted tickets. But without any further ado, please enjoy my insane conversation with Sasha Gervasi.
I'd like to welcome back to the show returning champion, Sasha Gervasi. There's Sasha.
I have no idea what's going on this morning, Alex, but we've just been talking for 10 minutes. We're just laughing. So hopefully people will forgive us for just being somewhat ridiculous.
And, this conversation is going to be somewhat ridiculous, that I can promise you without question.
What's new, Alex?
So, my friend, so for people who don't, I mean, you can come on a while ago on Indie Film Hustle and on Bulletproof Screenwriting. And we talked about your career writing The Terminal and writing, directing My Dinner with Irvay and Hitchcock and many other films. But we're here today to talk about, honestly, what you'll be remembered for. Let's just put it out there. I mean, on your gravestone, the man who brought Anvil.
I'm hoping I die on this podcast, so that will really be true.
I mean, that's going to boost the ratings. I'll give you that.
It's going to be good for you.
I mean, it's only going to be good for you.
Yeah, no, there is no doubt that Anvil, Anvil will be on my tombstone with, I told you I was ill.
That's a fantastic, I told you I was ill. Tell everybody the story of Anvil, because when we first spoke, you had such so many other highlights of your career that I wanted to kind of dig into, that I didn't realize there was like an 8-foot poster behind you as we were speaking of the story of Anvil. And
as as we've been gearing up to this release, people just want to talk about Anvil. It's like, you know, I'm working on The Crown right now. No one's interested. They want to focus on Anvil and Lips and Rob. And, you know, the story is very simple. I was a fan of this band Anvil. At 15, I met them at the Marquee in London. I showed them around London and they invited me to come on tour with them as a drum roadie. And so I was a 15, 16-year-old kid running around doing a Canadian hockey arena tour in like the summer of 1985. And that was the time of sort of Live Aid. And so I was, you know, there, set up Rob Reiner's drums at Metal Aid in Albany, New York. Not quite as glamorous, but it was pretty funny. Notable for the fact that the lead guitar player of the Scorpions came into the dressing room and said, "Who is Africa?" He thought it was a benefit show for a person called Africa. And someone had to point out, actually, Matthias, it's a continent. Anyway, so, you know, this was the kind of shit that was going on regularly. And I was just around for this, all this kind of like 80s metal stuff. But I was a kid, you know, and I was so in love with Anvil and particularly the drummer, Rob Reiner. His real name is Rob Reiner. People think that that's one of the reasons the movie is not real.
Spinal Tap.
Is the director of Spinal Tap and the drummer of Anvil have the same name. The reality is that's really his name. And so it began this journey for me that obviously continues now, you know, 45, you know, 50 years later or whatever it is. And it's just extraordinary with the films about to come out again into theaters nationwide.
Which we're going to get into story. So that's the basis of the story. So for everybody listening, Anvil is this amazing story of how not to follow. I mean, not how to follow your dreams, but also how not to follow your dreams and never give up, because there has to be a persistence. And since this is a podcast about, you know, artists and filmmakers and things like that, you know, being an artist is not easy. Being a creative is not easy in any field you get into. This film is one of those films that touches your heart. For anybody who's ever tried to do something and have been told no 1,000 times, but they should have stopped.
Yeah.
Years ago.
I mean, this is about two guys who, when they were 14, they made a pact to rock together forever. Here we are more than 50 years later and the band's still doing it. And they haven't sold millions of records and, you know, played Wembley and done all this stuff that one associates with a successful rock band. But what they have done is recorded 19 albums, kept touring, kept working, given up their day jobs. Their full-time gig is being an Anvil. And it is, as you said, about persistence. It's this extraordinary story about what happens when you refuse to give up on your dreams. You know, you just refuse. You're like, I don't care. I'm not getting the results. I'm not getting the money, but I'm just going to keep doing it. And somehow, if you just hang on, you know, some young fan from 30 years ago comes into your life, makes a movie about the struggle. And that movie in itself, you know, has completely propelled the band as well, has really helped the band because people have identified with, as you said, what it means to be an artist, what it really means to be an artist for most artists, right? It's very, very hard.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And so I think this was sort of one of the movie, the intention of the movie was for people to really appreciate the kind of, not just the dedication and commitment of not having the money and the success and the fame and all that stuff, but what it's about for them, but also the dedication and the support required from their families. A big part of the movie is interviewing the wives, is talking to the sister who plays a big role in the film, is what is the impact? What is the cost of refusing to give up your dreams? That's what the film is essentially about. And I think in a strange way, it's resonated because for most artists, this is some version of their life. You know, in other words, it's really hard. Maybe you have a moment of great success. Maybe it passes. Maybe you have another one. But, you know, for most artists, they do it because they love doing the thing. And they do it for reasons of passion and because they have to, because that's who they are. And, you know, sometimes you get the fame and the money, you know, sometimes you get it briefly in the case of Anvil, you know, but the point being that everyone can relate to this film. And I think the really shocking thing to me, because it's so, you know, Anvil is not, you know, the heavy metal music is not something that most people listen to, certainly not in the mainstream anymore. And it sort of, the film seems to have resonated beyond the heavy metal and rock community to any creative artist. So we've, over the years, I've had letters from, you know, long distance cyclists and potters and, you know, our friend Rich Roll is one of the biggest advocates of the film. Just people who really just recognize that universal story of struggling to do something you believe in and it not working and being so committed and so passionate about it that you just don't care. You just go like, screw it, I'm just going to keep going. And I think it's about the human spirit film ultimately. And it comes served up in a really quite unexpected package with Lips and Rob, you know, and at the beginning of the movie, you're kind of laughing at them going, oh my God, these Canadian headbangers, they're just so weird and crazy. But by the end, I think, you know, if the movie works for you, you feel a sense of empathy and compassion and you feel a sense of admiration because these guys are really doing it for the real reasons. They're not doing it
because they're getting
famous, you know, and ironically, of course, that this story, which is essentially about not giving up and about, in one sense, failure, some might say, but it has a happy ending. And that happy ending continues because they've been rewarded somehow. You know, it's just been extraordinary. Anyway, you can ask me anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's really fascinating because that's what I was when I saw the film for the first time in this in the most ideal way you can watch that film at your house in your screening room on a 35 millimeter print for the first time. And you're telling us stories about what happened on the set and things like that after the movie. That was the first time I got to see it. And I was crying at the end. I mean, I was literally tearing up because it connected with me at a really almost spiritual level because all of us have gone through that struggle of trying to make it. So two questions. One, how did you deal with your own rejections coming up in the business? Because I know the road wasn't paved with gold for you, as it isn't for most artists who've made any sort of significant career, you know, made a career of themselves. And two, after that, can you tell the story of how Anvil was birthed, the original phone call, like why you even got the idea to do Anvil in the first place? And like that whole story is fascinating. But first, you know, how do you deal with the, and I'm assuming still get notes. We all still get notes.
I mean, listen, here's the reality, man. You can have some success and have made films that have been popular or work with, you know, incredible people or whatever. You know, you're still going to get failure and rejection. That's the thing people don't realize. I think people on the outside of the business think, you know, once I get my first movie made or I sell my first script, you know, frankly, that's just making it to the battlefield. That's where the battle begins. It's an absolute miracle. It's a great thing to sell a script and to, you know, have a movie made, but you know, it's there's so many, just the war continues, the pitfalls, the potholes, the unexpected ups and downs, the kind of someone in really decides to market the movie wrong or release it on the wrong date, or you know, the actor's not right, or you know what I mean, like the most brilliant spec script in the world, that, you know, if it's cast wrong and made wrong, it doesn't work as a movie. You know, it's like there are so many things that need to go right. So you continue to encounter those. I think in my own experience, you continue to encounter that all the time, you know. So, but the thing is that I think when you have pulled off a few things, you know, you get some sense of confidence that even if you get a rejection or it doesn't work out, you're like, okay, we'll figure out another way. You just have, you have the faith that perhaps you don't have if you haven't had anything go right. You know what I mean? Like if you've had some things go right, then you're like, oh, okay, so there will be a way.
And then your origin story of how you got the terminal, essentially when you got the terminal, how it was based purely on a short film script.
Well, no. You mean Hervé was.
Hervé, oh, yes. Yeah. That whole story is, but before you tell the story, the thing I love about that is that you wrote down something that was so authentic to you. You put it all out on the table there. And even the power of that little short clip is what kind of launched your career.
It totally did. I mean, I had been a journalist and I really did not like the very cynical 90s sort of newspaper culture in Britain, which, I mean, still to a degree continues today. But it was extremely cynical. And you could just see a whole bunch of kind of, you know, people who found it much easier to sit on the sidelines being kind of shitty to other people and judging than actually, you know, have the balls to take any kind of risk on their own. And I just was part of that culture. I was a young kid. I was sent on an assignment. And I was sent to interview Hervé Villechaize, who at the time was a faded star, but had been the star of one of the biggest shows on American TV, and in fact, around the world in the early 80s, called Fantasy Island. And so I was sent on this, interview, which was kind of like a side dish to the much more important things I was supposedly doing in LA. This was like, go and make fun of a dwarf and come back. And, you know, it was that kind of thing. And I went in, frankly, filled with kind of judgment. I'd already written the story before I'd got there. And it was just like, take a few photos, you know, ha, 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 Hervé Villechaize. And, you know, there's actually a Vulture article about the real story. About my dinner with Hervé, Is It Real? You can look it up on vulture.com, which tells my first person narrative of what that experience was like. And then obviously it was adapted to a film. And the first time I met him, he actually pulled a knife on me.
As one does,
because I'd written the story and I was rushing to get somewhere else. And it's all in the film, you'll see. And he kind of said, you know, you're pathetic. You're not a reporter. You're not interested in the truth. You're just interested in trotting out the same old stereotypes and kind of screw you. So he pulled this knife to kind of like get my attention. And you know what? He was right. In the end, I spent three nights, I can't remember, over 5 days between all my other interviews. And at the end, you know, I just had such a completely different idea about who this person was versus who I thought they were. You know, I looked at him as a 3'10" kind of French dwarf with this funny voice. Hello, how are you? You know, all this stuff. And I just thought it was just surreal being with him. But when I got to know who that person actually was as a human being, what had gone on with his parents, how, you know, he'd been such an extraordinary artist, the youngest ever painter to have his work hung in the Museum of Paris as an 18-year-old. You know, he was very well educated, extremely sharp, urbane, cosmopolitan, very funny, and also completely screwed up by the multiple rejections that had, you know, happened throughout his life, and the primal rejection at a certain point of his mother. And I just felt such empathy for him. I really love this guy. But at the end, you know, so we really connected. And he opened my eyes to my own kind of cynicism and judgment, which was really, I needed. And so at the end, when we saw each other in Universal Sheraton, the scene is actually in the movie and we shot it in the place where it happened. You know, he leant down and his eyes were filled with this incredibly tragic defiance and tears. And he said, tell them I regret nothing. You know, it's actually in the movie and Peter Dinklage does the scene so beautifully. And it was this thing of, I had his story. And when I went back to the newspaper, that no one was really interested in that story. They were interested in, you know, all the other stuff. But what was really sad was 5 minutes after I left him in that lobby, I got a call from Kathy, his girlfriend, who in the movie is played by Mireille Enos, and to say that Hervé had committed suicide that morning. And so I had this 11 or 12 recorded hours of interview with this kind of faded, forgotten star who people thought was a joke. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to do something where I'm going to try and honor this person. And I wrote this piece and I went into the newspaper and literally they said, and the line is in the film, one of the editors said, well, Gervasi's top to midget. Where do we send him next? And they all started laughing.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And I was just like, I get it, but actually you have no idea who this person is. Read this article. And they would, and they cut it down and they just basically watered it down. And I realized that I had to tell this guy's story. I mean, basically 5 days before he died, I promised him that I would tell the story one way or another. And so I wrote, my first script was a short screenplay called My Dinner with Hervé, which was about this unexpected encounter with this sort of quote unquote joke celebrity, as they called him in the office. And, you know, that script was written from a place of the magazine's kind of ruined, you know, cut it down and it just didn't feel right. And I just have to tell his story. So that it took me 25 years to make the film, which I did eventually with Peter Dinklage starring as Hervé and Jamie Dornan in an amazing breakthrough performance, actually, which led to Belfast and Andy Garcia and Harriet Walter and stuff. I mean, it was and David Strathairn, of course. So, you know, it was an extraordinary epic journey to get it made. But it was that story, that 34-page short script, was the one that eventually ended up finding Spielberg found it and hired me to do The Terminal with Tom Hanks after that. So it was, it was an incredibly important moment in my life to just, and it was all about just standing up and going, I'm going to tell this story properly in a way that is more personal and talk about how much this experience and this person actually affected me. And so that was my dinner with Hervé. So yeah, it was the purity of it was the refusal to just kowtow to the prevailing culture of kind of cynicism, right, and frankly, in stupidity. And you know, just people want to, you know, like all the time. And we go through life, you know, life is fast. There's so much going on. We have to put people in a pigeonhole or put a situation. There's so much judgment. And so the point is, like, what if I just removed my judgment? What if I didn't have such a strong opinion about everything? You know, people use that in a way as a defense when they don't want to have to deal with something that's uncomfortable or unpleasant, which is fine. But it was how everything began for me, was that short script. And it was coming from a place of, I have to tell this story and I have to tell it.
And the thing that's fascinating about that story, and it's such a great example of what I've talked about all the time. People always ask me, how do you make it? How do you make it? What, you know, you've talked to so many, you know, screenwriters and filmmakers who've made it, like, what's the secret? And I'm like, the secret is you. It's your secret sauce. It's the thing that nobody else on the planet has other than you. And if you're brave enough to show it, that's what brings success. And in your example, there is literally no one else on the planet that could tell that story.
Yeah, I had to. I think everything you say is exactly correct. It's like, what is the thing that's singular or unique to you? The experience you've had, maybe in a family, maybe in a work situation, maybe as an artist, whatever it is. What is that story whose perspective only you are able to provide and tell and explore? And that's there was no one else who could have told that story. And frankly, My Dinner with Hervé and Anvil, The Story of Anvil, are two examples of extremely personal stories. And actually both movies end with a photo of me and the subject. Because, you know, I think part of doing these movies is not to be successful, whatever that even means. It's to make sense of your own life. You know, it's like, why, what was all that about? You know, Anvil is partially, I was this 15-year-old fan who kind of ran away from home and joined the circus and went on the road with a heavy metal band, which my mother was not happy about, obviously. And it was like, what was all that about? In that case, it was the music, it was escape, it was growing up, it was becoming an individual, it was kind of going, screw you, you know, it was like the normal teenage stuff. And with Hervé, it was about something, putting something right in myself. Forget the culture of the newspapers. It was like, oh, okay. So I was putting him in a pigeonhole and rushing to judge and being cynical. You know, I don't want to be like that. I don't want to be a cynical person who's not open to other people just because he happened to be 3'10". Anyway, so my point is that sometimes you do a project, you write a script, you make a movie, you only realize after you've made it why you did it. And so, but you just have to follow that instinct. And as you say, do the thing that only you specifically can do. And those two photograph films, as I call them, because they end with that photo, one of me at the lips of Anvil, one of me and Hervé. There's a third one coming, which will be, there'll be three films eventually after I do this other film. But Those are the personal films, man. And those are the ones that resonate mostly with me. And I think also with other people, you know, so that's just my own impression. But, you know, you've got to, and I do them because I love, I have something to express that I think it's important that I think other people are going to recognize. We've all been cynical. We've all been wild and carefree and young and wanting to kind of go out into the world, which was the Anvil thing. You know, we've all, it's like that, those universal things are the reason I do stuff, because I want to connect with other people, because I want to say, you know, I've had this experience. You probably had something similar, you know, and it's that sense of connection of not being completely isolated and alone, which mm-hmm. I think well, certainly I seek. You know, that's why you get into film, is because, you know, the first time, for example, I saw Anvil play at Sunset and at Sundance, you know, we were in no one really had seen the film apart from Sundance programmers, and they seemed to like it. But, you know, you never know until you put it in front of an audience. And we premiered it in the library, and that sense of the response afterwards, and when Lips and Rob came out and there was the incredible, you know, overwhelming applause for them, and just a momentous reaction to the film, you know, it's like, oh, okay. So all of that, the years of work and financing this movie myself and going through all the ups and downs of trying to pull a film together, it was all worth it. Someone heard you. Someone related. It meant something to someone. And I think I told this story to you. I don't know if I did, but after the premiere of Anvil, like 660 people came out of the library, and Anvil was sitting with a little van selling T-shirts and CDs in the snow. And like 600 people were like lining up. And there was this really nice old lady, elderly lady. And she went up to Anvil and she was posing for photos. And she bought three copies of their CD, This Is 13. And as she was leaving, I went up to her with my producer, Rebecca Heller. I said, excuse me, madam. Just out of interest, why did you buy three Anvil CDs? I mean, it doesn't seem like you're a heavy metal fan. You know, she held them up and she said, I will never listen to these, but I just want to help. And she was like a 70-something-year-old, you know, school teacher in Park City. She was a school teacher who went to her local film festival, Sundance. And that's when we knew we had something. That's when we knew, okay, this movie is reaching people just as human beings, you know, and that's what... You know, you can't buy that kind of sense of excitement and relief and satisfaction where the story you're trying to tell, the themes of the story resonate with people, you know, who you would never expect them to resonate with. That's a beautiful thing, because then me and that lady are connected and we probably have nothing else in common. But somehow this movie created a connection. So I know it sounds hippie-like, but, you know, I like that.
No, of course.
Film to reach people, you know?
Yeah, it's not hippie at all. I mean, look, the thing that's so beautiful about Anvil is that even if you just watch the trailer, there's a level of that these guys are pathetic, that you're like, this is never going to happen. Like, you guys should stop. Their family is like, they should stop. It's over. Yeah. It was over years ago.
Long time ago.
They had their moment. They're in the movie, they're like 50-something at that point. You know,
50. I mean, by the way, just so you know, the guy's now Lips is 66,
and he's still rocking.
Yeah, and he's still going, and he'll go until
he dies on stage. Until he just dies on stage.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no question. But that's the thing that's so beautiful about this, because as a director and as a storyteller, you brought us in and really showed us the life of a failed artist, of two failed artists who won't let go, even though everything around them is saying, you're just not, it's not going to work, man. It's not going to happen for you.
Yeah.
And that's so difficult, because I think every artist at one point or another comes to that come to Jesus moment.
Yeah, of course.
Where you look in the mirror and you go, am I good enough to make a go at this? And then if the answer is no, they either get out and go get a real job, or they go, I'm going to give it 5 years. I'm going to give it 10 years. And if it doesn't work, these guys gave it 20 odd years, 30 years, and they still were like.
But I think that's what I think is beautiful, is like, if you're willing to really commit, if you're really, really willing to never give up, that's what it looks like. But if you never give up, it allows for the possibility of some kind of miracle to happen some way. And this movie was what happened to those guys.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I didn't know what I was doing when I was making it. I think they had less clue. But, you know, here we are. And when it came out the first time, you know, I remember standing, AC/DC asked Anvil to open some of their stadium shows. And I remember standing on the stage at Giant Stadium and 50,000 people were screaming, Anvil, 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 you know. And you could never have predicted that, you know. And so it's just magic happens, you know. So, when it's all over.
so let's talk about that magic, because you literally, I mean, so everyone understands, a 15-year-old roadie goes off to Hollywood, mm-hmm. makes a go of it. He's doing all right, hanging out with Steven and Tom, and you know, yeah. And doing and he's building a career for himself. And then he goes, you know what? I wonder whatever happened to Anvil.
Yeah, that's
so exactly. Please pick up the story from there, because so, the I mean, making, you know, I like Hollywood,
how I'd had my first movie made with Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks, or, you know, there's obviously, you know, good, amazing.
So if you could get that kind of work, it's fantastic.
No, it was amazing. No, and Tom and Steven were fantastic and hit. You know, they were taking some young kid from London and, you know, giving him a chance to make a movie with them, which was, you know, extremely rare and exceptional. I'll never forget that, because it created my career. Mm-hmm. And it gave me choices and options to go off and do things. And you know, what an amazing gift. And I, you know, I remember stepping onto the set of The Terminal for the first time. And I was just like, because I'd made a little movie at Warner Brothers called The Big Tease, which was my first film. And I remember Walter Parks, the producer, took me onto the set of Terminal, and he was holding my eyes. And he like said, okay. And I opened and I looked and it was like a fully functioning airport. and it was like, you know, the set of The Terminal had cost $16 million, I think, at the time, which is like four times the budget of my entire first movie. And I was just like, you know, this was me sitting in a room, you know, trying to get some story together based on this true story of Alfred Nasseri at Paris Airport, at Charles de Gaulle. And it was magic, you know, when you realize that it's so hard to be a writer, it's so hard to be creative. But if you just hang out long enough and you keep going, then, you know, and hundreds of people end up going to work. You know, that's a good feeling, to feel like your creativity has employed a lot of people when you're on a set and you think, this came from me sitting there on my own. You know, so that was a lovely thing. And it was a great experience for me. And Hanks was extraordinary. And I loved Tom Hanks. So, and Steven too. They were and remain wonderful. So, you know, and then I had choices about what I wanted to do. And ironically, from that situation, I really thought, you know, I want to be a director, you know, and no one was going to give me a job to direct. But that was going on in my mind. And then also going on in my mind was, here I am, I've made a movie with Spielberg and Hanks, you know, making a living, doing sort of sitting in some Malibu beach house, whatever, you know. And I was just thinking about life. And then I was like, God, whatever happened to Anvil? I went online and I discovered, you know, that band who I'd been on the road with and I'd known so well over those sort of from 1982, I first met them, to about 86. For those 4 or 5 years, I'd really known them very well and been out on 3 tours. And, you know, so I looked them up and I discovered that they were still going and that they'd done like 10 albums I'd never heard of. And they were playing a pub in Quebec. And there are all these photos from their last show at this pub. And anyway, I wrote to the website and I said, you know, dear website manager for Anvil, I'm an old friend. Anyway, an hour later, I got an email back directly from Lips. There was no website manager. I mean, this website did not need a manager. And the email was like, Teabag, which is my Anvil name, we thought you died or became a lawyer. And I was like, well, both sort of happened. I went to law school and nearly died for another reason. But so he flew out to L.A., Lips, and I picked him up at LAX. I got him a ticket to come the following weekend. And he was like, hey, man, how you doing? And he was like, as he is in the movie, he was like, so filled with enthusiasm. And he's like, yeah, we're doing these songs for this new record. And I mean, he was wearing the same Scorpions t-shirt that I'd last seen him in 24 years before. He was literally wearing that.
It's not an exaggeration.
It was like, nothing had changed. I was like, what is going on? I took him to my good friend, Steve Zalian, the screenwriter, who had actually been the one that introduced me to Steven Spielberg and began my career. So I took Lips, this crazy Canadian headbanger, over to my friend Steve's place. And, him, you know, Lips, I remember I was making coffee with Steve and looking through the window of his kind of kitchen out into the garden just by the ocean. And Lips was there with Steve's wife, Elizabeth. And he was going, yeah, man, we're going to do this record. And, you know, this is Anvil. And she was like looking slightly frightened. But, you know, he was so enthusiastic and sweet. And Steve said, you know, tell me who this guy is that you brought to my house. And I told him the story. I was a roadie. And, you know, he said, my God, and these guys are still going for it. And I'm like, yes, they're still going for it. He said, you know, he's a very interesting character. Maybe there's a film there. And I was like, yeah, what are you talking about? So anyway, that germinated the idea where Steve just thought, he noticed there was something about this guy and about the themes of this story about never giving up when basically you should have, as he said. And it was just something like that happened. And it took me a couple of months, and I went to the Toronto Film Festival, and I was with Rebecca Yelder, my producer, who came in to produce the movie, who had done Motorcycle Diaries and The Kite Runner. And, you know, she'd also been a programmer at Sundance. Brilliant, brilliant producer. She was, had a film there, I think. I can't remember. But so she went to meet Anvil with me. She said, well, I hate heavy metal, but let me meet these guys. Let's just see what happens. So she was like, they're incredible. She just thought they were so larger than life, such extraordinary characters. And she took us to this restaurant, and then Lips started crying when he got the menu. And Rebecca's like, are you okay? And Lips was like, yeah, well, I delivered fish to this restaurant for 9 years, and this is the first time I've ever had a meal upstairs.
Oh my!
And Rebecca was like, oh my God.
Oh. You know?
So she was like, okay, I get it. Okay. And so that began the adventure of, okay, let's just go make this movie. We'll put a crew together. I put an amazing crew. I had Chris Seuss, fantastic DP. I had Matt Dennis. I had incredible editors, Jeff Renfro and Andrew Dickler, who really became my creative partner, is absolutely brilliant. He also cut Palm Springs, by the way, like a brilliant. He came in, did a fantastic job. And we just made this movie at my kitchen table. And for 2 years, we traveled around the world, and you know, no one was going to give me the money to it. I remember going to my agents at the time, and they were like, so you don't want to do the Jim Carrey rewrite. You want to do a self-financed documentary about an unknown heavy metal, Canadian heavy metal band. And I was like, yeah. And they're like, okay. And I was, but they didn't get it. You know, that's so important that if you have an artistic instinct, expect that no one is going to support it. Expect that everyone's going to think you're crazy. But I kind of knew in myself I had to make the movie. And it was a huge risk. There was no one, there's no way I can go into a room in Hollywood and pitch that story. No one's going to care, because I didn't even know it was there an ending. What is it? You know, it's like, if I think of one of my favorite movies of all time, if I was to go and pitch it in a room, it's two unemployed actors go to Wales for the weekend. That's With Nail and I. It's one of the greatest British films ever made, right? It doesn't, it's who those people are in those circumstances. It's the comedy, it's the pathos, it's, you know, the story of male bonding. It's a story of ultimately success and failure in a certain kind of way. Once one moves on, the other is stuck, you know. So it's just all about the specifics of what that is. And there was no way. So I had to finance the movie myself. So I did. And I got these rewrite jobs, and I was just like, for the 2 years, just editing at my house and trying to put it together. And then even when we went to Sundance, right, you know, it was 2008. It was the bottom of the documentary market. It was basically the bottom of the market. It was a bad time, as everyone remembers 2008 to be. People loved the movie. No one wanted to buy it. So we had one offer from the UK. They were absolutely mad for it, as they still are to this day. This crazy company called The Works, they offered us, they bought the movie for the UK for a big enough sum that we were able to kind of get some of the money back. And then I got offered this big DVD deal for the States. And I was like, I'm not going to do it, man. I've seen this movie play now at Sundance, at Hot Docs, at all these festivals, and the audience loves it. I've got to get it in front of them somehow. So in the end, I was like, I hired this brilliant guy called Richard Abramovitz, who's actually also involved in the re-release, Abramorama, and we sort of put it together. And we released, I just took out a mortgage on my house, which is, by the way, insane. And I would absolutely
advise not to do this.
No one else to do this, because it was completely mad. Because me and the band were at the same thing, you know, that we were all on the edge. I had everything I'd ever earned was in this movie. Everything.
Wow.
Because I was that crazy about it. It wasn't just delusion. It was like I'd seen the movie play and I knew how audiences reacted. So I was just kind of trusting that. I just like somehow, some way, we got to get it to the audience. So We released the movie into 10 cities.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And it's because, you know, it's in the last 13 years since it's released, it's just gone on and on to the point where, Alex, and you're right at the epicenter of this, the movie's being re-released into theaters again. So on September 27th of 2022, which is 2-3 weeks from now, the movie goes out into 215 theaters, which is 6 times the size of the original release.
Oh my God. I'm laughing because insanity.
It's insane. Oh. I mean, it's just crazy.
Okay, all right. So before we get to the release, which
is ridiculous.
All right, and I love that story so much because it really does truly show. And you both were basically at the same place. Yeah, you had some success, but you were putting it all on the line. You're like putting everything
on the line. And that's another thing is that if you want to progress in life, I think in general, and you'll know this too, you know, you've got to take some risks and you've got to know what that risk is and what moment to take that risk.
Right.
And it was like, I put everything on 22 Black. And if it hadn't come up, I don't know where I'd be. Because honestly, I just knew I just had to trust what I saw with my own eyes and ears with the audiences who were responding. And you, when you came to that first screening, I mean, what did you think the response was from the audience?
I mean, it was insane. Everybody, like most of the people there hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
And everybody was, you know, crying and laughing. And, you know, when you first watch that movie, the first part, you're just like, you're just kind of laughing. You're like, these guys are they act clownish. They're kind of ridiculous, if not fully ridiculous. Yeah. But then as the movie progresses, you start to connect with them at a deeper level. So at first, there's the spectacle, oh, look, ha, 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 look at these losers. They're not going anywhere. But then when you start going in the arc of the hero's journey, if you will, that arc, you start going like, but they're not stopping. This is not funny anymore.
Yeah.
Because they're serious. They're not morons. They're not idiots. They're not people who, they're just passionate. Might be misplaced passion, but
right.
But passion nevertheless.
That's exactly the journey of the movie. And I explained this to the band at the beginning. I said, look, for this movie to work, you know, I'm going to have to be 100% honest with you, and you're going to have to trust me a bit. But the reality is, I'm going to encourage the audience to laugh at you at the beginning.
Yes.
Number one, you're fucking hilarious. Okay. let's just face that. Number two, I think the audience will go from a place of laughing at you to recognizing underneath the passion and the perseverance that you were talking about. By the end, they're going to really admire you. And I said, to make that journey, you know, tonally is so complex from step to step, because this is literally a movie that has a guy playing a red flying V with a dildo in a bondage harness, right? That's in the movie. And also the Holocaust is in the movie because Rob Reiner is the survivor, is the son of a survivor.
Correct.
So, of Auschwitz. So when you've got such crazy extremity in the film, you have to build that tonal journey little by little, and I explain that to them, and I think they really appreciated it, because after that they really trusted me, because I said to them, if there's anything in the film that you really, really object to, I'll take it out. I don't want to put you in a situation where you feel uncomfortable. And it was because I'd been their fan and their roadie that they knew that, and they knew I was telling the truth, that they trusted me. And I think that's a big thing. The reason the movie works is it's so intimate, because it's about me with my friends in the most sort of intimate, private moments that go on behind the scenes, as it turns out, with many bands. Mm-hmm. And actually, when Metallica saw the movie, Lars called me up and said, and he's in the movie, Lars Ulrich, and he said, you know, me and the boys watched Anvil on the jet drinking champagne, and we were all in tears, because that could have been us. And, you know, it's a very truthful, intimate film.
And by the way, what Lars says is absolutely true, because it's not that they didn't have the talent to do what they're doing. It's that the chips fall where they fall for certain people and certain groups. And sometimes there's that one thing that happens that they're like, oh, you opened up for this one band and that one person was in this in the audience that then booked you on a tour. And like, and it just goes up. There's so much luck that's involved.
So much luck. And I think any artist knows that if they're successful or they have some luck, it's about so many things. But you can't have the luck if you don't persevere, if you don't keep going.
Absolutely.
But that said, you know, we all know this. I mean, look around at the world right now. Life is not fair and life makes no sense. Why is it we have, you know, a war in the Ukraine? You know, why is it that people who are
pandemic?
Pandemic impacted by the energy crisis. So disparately unfair. Why is it that, you know, the lower income households are having to pay more? You know, that just the world is so unfair. So you have to factor in the fact that so many factors are involved in why someone has a successful artistic career and why someone doesn't, and that you can't control all the elements and you just have to do your best and give everything you can. But one thing I do know is that if you don't give up,
something will happen.
There's a possibility that something happens. And that's exactly what happens at the end of the Anvil movie. So it's important. It's like, if you're doing everything you can, you're doing everything you can. But just trust the universe that if you're doing the right thing for the right reason, somehow, somewhere, you get rewarded. Somehow, somewhere.
And people always ask me, and this is just, I'll throw my journey in here for a second, is that when I started podcasting in 2015, I just showed up every day. And I did two episodes a week, like nobody else. And there was no money. There was no nothing. Right. It was just kind of like, I'm just going to show up and pound the stone, pound the stone. Cut wood, carry water, pound the stone, cut wood, carry water. That's all I did. And then people like were like, oh, well, you know, you got Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone was episode 425.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just so you understand. Like,
yeah.
Before then, I was like, and then after Oliver showed up, then a lot of doors opened up and then people like yourself and other guests started coming up and then it became what it's become now. But that was episode 425, 425 other episodes without any major Oscar winners or, you know, any major, you know, people other than filmmakers just grinding it in and out.
I mean, look, you know, it's like the same example in my case, you know, with The Terminal. It wasn't the first screenplay I ever wrote. It was probably the 30th. And it all came down to when I was at, or the 25th or whatever. It all came down to when I was at film school. I could not finish a script. At the end of my first year at UCLA at the MFA screenwriting program, the head of the program came to me and he said, look, you got to finish this script. And I was like, I can't. It's not good enough. Blah, blah, blah. He said, if you don't finish this script, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to ask you to consider leaving the program because that's what we're here to do. And I was like, but it's going to be terrible. It's horrible. And he said, it doesn't matter. You just have to finish it. And so I finished this script and it was indeed absolutely unreadably awful. It was terrible. But, you know, he congratulated me. He said, you finished it. And he said, you've got to allow yourself to be bad before you even have the possibility of being good. So many of us are like, I've got this idea and I've got to protect myself legally because this first idea I've had is, you know, it's a process. It's like you've got to write a lot of scripts before you start to get the hang of it. It's like riding a bike. You don't just get on it and you win the Tour de France. You know, you've got to get on and work and be in a process. You've got to go to the gym. You've got to write some terrible scripts. You've got to have some heartache. You've got to not be able to finish a script. You've got to, you know, it's such a part of earning that success. You know, is failure is such a critical component, I think, to success. You have to be able to embrace it, to learn from it, to be willing to go through the experience of what it feels like to be a failure. I've done that a lot and I will do it again. That's just life. And I think, you know, people just imagine, I remember at film school at UCLA, it was all, I've got to get an agent. Like getting an agent was like this magical solution. It's irrelevant. You know, someone said to me, there's a reason why you're 90% and they're 10%. It's just a little piece of connective tissue that helps you get into the industry or whatever. But it's the script. It's the work. It's the thing you're doing that is going to get you the agent. The agent doesn't have any power to make a screenplay well-written or to make a story well-told. You know, they're just, you know, servants of the business, right? So I just think it's interesting. It's important for people to bear in mind that it's a long journey. to get anywhere at anything, whether it's screenwriting or violin or doing pottery or
being a heavy metal band.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Or being in a heavy metal band or designing maps or, you know, whatever it is that you do, you know, the people who are good at it did not get good at it by snapping their fingers. It's a real commitment.
And for people listening too, like, because now we're in a different generation now, different time in history where YouTubers and everybody wants to be famous and everybody wants to do this. And then everyone looks at someone like Mr. Beast, who has 100 million subscribers. And he said it, he's like, the first 10 years.
Yeah.
The first 10 years, I barely made it.
Yeah, totally.
Because it takes a long time. So, and that's what film schools don't want to teach you. They don't want to, who's going to buy that product? Hey, we're going to teach you something that's going to take you about 10 years to make a living at it. Like, it's horrible marketing. Without question. Okay, so.
So now you want to go to the present moment, Alex?
So let's go to the present. So let's go to the present moment of Anvil. So I go over. I'm going to tell the story from my point of view.
Remind me of the madness that ensued. I'm having oatmeal. Please forgive me.
So we are. So I go over, see the movie for the first time, and the audience is fantastic in your screening room, which is a whole other. Your screening room was in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's Al Pacino's screening room in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I can quickly tell you, Quentin Tarantino came to the house. He said, I need to use this room for my movie. My wife was like, absolutely not. We make movies. We're not having a film crew anywhere near this house. Anyway, so I made this deal with Quentin, which is like, if we let you use this room, because it's a real 35 room that he wanted, I need a 35 print of Once Upon a Time in America.
Or Hollywood, yeah.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And he gave me one. He was amazing.
And I remember the day you got it. You called me up. You're like, do you want to come see this?
You want to come see it? And it could only be shown in that room. And it cut, you know, it's like, no, but the point being that he was so cool about it. And I was like, okay, if he wants this room, then I want to print the finished movie. And he was amazing about it. But when it came to getting the print, this is a side story. They're so kind of, you know, these prints are like gold, you know, like we keep it in a vault because you have to keep it under, you know, under security. And, you know, all the paperwork, all the Sony people, and like Rothman, Tom Rothman, head of Sony, had to like approve this print was given. And Rothman was like, why is this guy getting the print? Like Quentin had to go, no, we agree. That's the deal. Anyway, I got the print, but it was like getting something out of Fort Knox. It was unbelievable.
I didn't know it was that big of a deal, but I guess it does make sense. Yeah.
They made so few of them and they struck a print and they gave me this print. And anyway, so thank you, Quentin, if he happens to be listening.
So I go see that movie. And then, by the way, for people, when I'm in the room, there's a bunch of very cool looking older gentlemen in the room. Like older gentlemen that should not look as cool as they look.
Who were they?
No, I'm walking in there and you're like, oh, that's Culture Club.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
No, Boy George wasn't there with you, but it was Culture Club. And he works for Rod Stewart. And I'm like, this makes more sense.
David Palmer, the drummer of Rod Stewart. And we had Jim James, who was the lead singer of My Morning Jacket. And all these kind of musos wanted to see the movie. Yeah.
Right. So we see it then. And then like a few weeks later, you call me up like, hey, we're having another screening of Anvil. Do you want to come over? And I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, I got to see Anvil again. I have no problem. So let's go back over. And we watch the movie again with a new audience inside the screening room. And then at the end of the screening room, I pulled you aside and I said, you know, I want you to come back on the show just to talk about Anvil, because I feel it's a movie that needs to be talked about in today's world because it has such a great message. And I think so many people need to hear the message of Anvil. And I go, oh, by the way, I'm working with this distribution company who's a friend of mine, and we're trying to put some stuff together. Would you be interested in re-releasing this? And that's how the conversation, that was the germ of the idea. And then you went off and you're like, it's a 15-year-old. I'm like, yeah, we'll do like a 15-year release party. Like we'll do a small thing and this and that. And then that's how the whole idea started. And then, of course, and then that rev, like that germ of an idea revved up very quickly in your head.
I know. And then in the end, it was just crazy. And the whole thing, these screenings began really with my godson, Rio, who's 17. And his mother produced, Rebecca produced the movie. And so Rebecca and I had made this film, and Rio was, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. So last summer, he said to me, look, because I'm his godfather, he said, I'd love to see that movie you and mom made, you know, all those years ago, because I was a kid. So I said, sure, I'll show it. I invited him, and he brought all these friends from high school.
Yeah.
And this the whole thing began because he brought all these kids to see this movie none of them had heard of, obviously, apart from Rio. And they went nuts for the film. And we were like, what is going on? This is like a 13-year-old documentary. And these kids have never heard of it. And they're vibing with it. And it was post-COVID. And it was just landing this story about two best friends never giving up on a dream. It just really resonated with them. So that's where you and I started talking. And then I started talking with these guys at Utopia. And it was astonishing, you know, that this screening that began, let me show my godson this movie that I made with his mom, that ended with offers from two separate distributors to bring it back out and to restore the film. So
to restore the film, to bring it back out. And the thing that's so fascinating to me, and we keep joking about this because Utopia is run by friend of the show, Rob.
Yeah.
Rob, who was on the show before. And I keep telling you, every time I talk to him, like, Rob knows this movie was released 13 years ago. Like, he understands this is not a new movie.
Well, this is the thing, because they've really gone for it. And we have two large billboards on Sunset.
What?
And so people are calling us up going, sorry, this movie was released before, but the great thing is they're acting like it hasn't been, because to the audience they want to get, they've never even heard of this film, a lot of them. So now they've just gone for it. And it's, as I said, Richard Abramovitz, who released the movie the first time around, Utopia's brought him in. And it goes to, I think the current count is like 215 or 17 screens at the end of this month. I mean, yeah. And so we're doing this big event in LA on the 22nd. At the Saban Theater, where we're showing the restored movie on a giant screen in front of 1,200 people. And then the band is going to come out and play at the end. And we have Scott Ian from Anthrax and many other, you know, luminaries coming out to jam with them. It's going to be complete madness. And then New York next Tuesday, we've sold out the Angelica with Peter Dinklage as the host. And, you know, it's crazy. It's all happening again around this movie that... It's just a weird, it's got this magical energy, this film, you know, and
this is unprecedented.
It's never been done. Theatrical re-release of a documentary from, I think because since Anvil came out, you've had all these incredible movies like Searching for Sugar Man and Amy and 20 Feet from Stardom. In fact, one of the things that happened with Anvil was, you know, it didn't get longlisted for an Academy Award due to the voting procedure. They changed the voting rules, actually, in the Academy, in the doc branch, as regards music documentaries because of Anvil, because so many people were upset that it didn't get, it got some amazing recognition. But as a result, when Searching for Sugar Man won the Academy Award, you know, 2 years or 3 years after Anvil came out, Simon Chin, the producer, who's a good friend, called me up and said, thank you to Anvil, because had the rules not changed, we never would have been in the situation to even win in the first place. So Anvil came ahead of this sort of the Amy Sugar Man 20 Feet from Stardom thing. And it was considered, I guess, you know, reasonably influential. So I think that it's one of those movies which changed the paradigm a little. And so I think that's one of the other reasons why it's being re-released again, because it was sort of before all this kind of, this recent kind of rise of documentaries, particularly music documentaries.
I'm fascinated to see how it does. I am absolutely fascinated to see.
Me what too.
The numbers are going to be, wouldn't it be crazy if this like starts to turn into something? Like,
I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it already has. I mean,
you've won, Sasha.
It's already being re-released. I mean, you know, I'm going to the Grove to do a Q&A in LA, which is a pretty big theater. And our premiere is twice the size of the original premiere. We had an amazing premiere at the Egyptian. Cinema. Yeah, we did that. But this place is with the band too, and it's twice the size. So,
and there's going to be a few, and there's going to be a few fans there. And that's the thing that's too, is like, you have fans of this film. Like some of the biggest movie stars in the world, some of the biggest rock bands in the world, they're huge star fans of this.
Well, it's just really, I mean, they relate to it. I mean, I was
any artist does.
I was at a screening in London. It's really interesting. I was screening in London a year and a half ago, and it was like Gillian Anderson from The X-Files, you know, obviously many other things, Margot Robbie, Olivia Colman.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Boy George, I mean, Lulu, who's a famous singer from the 60s in England, who's brilliant to Sir With Love. They all went nuts for this movie. So I don't really know how to explain it. There's just something about it where people recognize something.
So I have to ask you, Rob and Lips and Rob, who are the two stars of this opus. Yeah. What did they think about this? Because I was there. I think it was Lips that popped up one of our original Zoom meetings. I got to see Lips. When you called them back up and go, "Hey boys, we're doing a massive re-release of Anvil theatrically around the around America,
around the world." By the way, Britain is bringing it back too.
Obviously, so
Altitude, who released Searching for Sugarman, actually are re-releasing it into theaters in the UK. It's we've just done a deal with Australia. It's going back around the world again in this new restored version.
So what did they say when you called them about this?
They were just like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" I'm like, "I don't really know.
Like, this is the end. We had our run. 13. We're good. Thank you."
Correct. Yeah, exactly. I didn't think it took them quite some time to believe it until until actually recently, and this is another thing going on right now, they started talking in the UK about Anvil, the film, and the band playing the Royal Albert Hall together.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So that, I think that was what really went, Lips was like, oh, we're going to maybe do the Royal Albert Hall. Okay. He started freaking out about that. I think it was just a bit like, it's this very unusual thing, but it's like Top Gun, you know what I mean? Top Gun Maverick. Over the years of Top Gun, I mean, this is obviously not on the same scale. I'm not that deluded. But
you know, could you imagine?
Yeah. I want to see Top Gun Maverick and Anvil Story of Anvil, Double Bill, the feel-good hits of the year. But the point being that over the years, like everyone loves Top Gun. And so I think what's happened with Anvil is that people have found the film over the years. Obviously, 0.1% of the scale of Top Gun, but there is a fondness and a love for that film, which seems to have grown. And it's exciting because you just never know, man, what's going to happen. Like, I would never have predicted that 13 years after the original release, there'd be a release, you know, four or five times that size. And the band is still here. They're still doing it. They've done 6 albums since, you know, it's...
And look at all of the elements the universe put together for this to happen. I invited you on a podcast.
That's right.
We became friends.
Yeah.
I go to a screening. We talk. The kids had to come and you saw that reaction. We have this guy. Like, there's so many parts that had to fall into place for this to be released. And then you found Utopia, who's insane. And I still say they're insane. I wish them all the best. But they're absolutely. And you just showed me pictures of the billboards on something like, What?
We have
a building.
We have half a building covered in Anvil. And then we have above Gil Turner's on Sunset. For those who know LA, I mean, it's like one of the prime spots at the intersection of Sunset and Doheny. For the entire month, we have an Anvil billboard standing alone. And it's like people are calling up, but they're laughing because they're like it's making people laugh. I love that. That it's just, we are the underdog story. Like, you've got the Anvil billboard, and then you've got, like, you know, Euphoria season 2, or, you know, Lord of the Rings, the Power of the Rings sequel, whatever. I mean, just people are laughing. It's because it's ridiculous. But that's sort of part of what Anvil is the absurdity, the little engine that could madness that this film has always had. And so I kind of love the fact that Robert and Utopia are acting as if it hasn't been released before.
God bless them, man. God bless them. And and you've been kind enough to give 2 free tickets
to the big premiere in LA. It's going to be
the big premiere in LA, which I'm going to, if you guys are interested in, I'm going to be there. I'm flying out from Austin to go just specifically to go see it.
Amazing.
Again, and to hang with you guys. But we're going to be
Alex, it'll be you and me and the ticket winners in a 1,500 or 1,200 seat auditorium with Anvil. But the great thing is, They'll give amazing. The best show of their lives. If there's four of us, it won't matter. They'll play it like Giant Stadium.
And that's as the movie has showed, because we saw some of those.
I know. Oh,
In the pub, in the tree. If you guys just watch the trailer in the show notes, you just see like they're in a pub, and there's just like the one dude in a chair like this, and right next to Rob, because it's such a small venue that Rob is like literally bumping into the guy in the chair.
But
they're going hard. They're going hard
because that's their point. Is that it doesn't matter if there's one person or a million people in the audience, they go for it. They still give the same show.
And the lessons that this film can teach all of us as filmmakers, as screenwriters, as artists, as people in general of what we're trying to do in life, it's so valuable. That's what I saw in the film. That's why I brought that idea up to you. And like, we got to get this out. I want people to know about this story, because God, it's just such a ridiculous, wonderful, touching, insane story that will uplift and make you laugh. It'll make you cry. I mean, it's Top Gun. Let's just call it. It's Top Gun Maverick.
I'm going to send this to you. I actually got when I was on the road with Anvil at the time, right? I actually took a break in one of the tours in '86 to go to a family bar mitzvah. And so there's this film that my cousin unearthed, which has been digitized, which is, I really want to send you because I wish you would put it in your notes. Let me see if I can find it. Hold on. I'll find it.
Oh my God, send it to me. I'll put it on the notes. Absolutely.
It's just complete madness, dude. It's just, hold on 1 second. But anyway, so I'm feeling like really quite encouraged by the response so far. Yeah. And, you know, whatever happens, it's great gravy. You know what I mean? It's just like, does it matter?
It doesn't matter. But the thing is, look, I'm just happy to be a very, very small part.
You had a big part in it, dude.
I'm just glad to be any part of this release. And that, I mean, my God, I hope it can make 1% of what Top Gun did.
Shall I show you this thing? So my cousin, when I was on tour with Anvil, shot this video in 1986. And it's going to go on to TikTok. I'm just going to play this in your screen. Hold on.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah. Oh, fucking good, Rob. Man. And if you don't buy the new album, it's my...
Holy cow. Is that who I think it is?
It's me. So I'm going to send this to you.
Send it. I'll put it up. I'll post it on social media. Madness. It's going to be great.
This was when I was like 17 or 16 or whatever. So I'm going to send this to you, Alex. And it's one of the TikTok things we're doing again. It's all being marketed in a completely different way, right?
It's just insane. This is a case that, listen, if it makes $1 billion, hell, if it makes $100 million.
If it makes $100.
If it makes $100, I need you to come back on the show, and we have to talk about what happened afterwards.
I'm happy to do anything.
This is the ever-ending story.
Even if it makes enough money for you and I to have dinner at Soup Plantation, I'll be thrilled. You can have anything on the left side of the menu. I have a coupon. It's going to be great.
Gosh, man. I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests because I think for this episode, I think it really makes sense. What is what advice would you give a filmmaker or screenwriter or anybody trying to follow their dreams, trying to get to where they want to go?
I think the thing to do for me is to try and find a way to filter out other people's opinions. Because a parent will have an opinion or a friend, or that will never work. You know, people can throw kind of wet blankets on what may be great ideas. So I think it's just being quite determined to just be true to what you know to be true. Like I said, you know, with Anvil, everyone was like, this will never work. Literally, people would say, this will never work. It's self-financed. You're being crazy. Who's going to watch this movie? You know, and here we are 13 years later with the second release of the film. So it's just, you got to trust your own instinct. Just know what you know and expect that other people will not support it or frankly even understand it, because only you know what you need to do. So that's, I think, one big aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because there's no trick, there's no secret. It all comes down to the movie or the script. It all comes down to the quality of the work. And that comes from your own authenticity with yourself, you know, your own kind of like, okay, this makes me laugh or this makes me cry or I feel something around this story. Just trust your own feelings around your story. I mean, I knew with Anvil, you know, I just knew there was something good about it. Like, you can't tell me that it's not commercial. You can't tell me. You may be right. I don't give a shit what you're saying. What I'm focused on is I know this is there's something special here. And just, you know, and don't doubt your instinct. So that's the thing I would say is do not doubt your own private instinct about what it is.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Now, what did you learn from your biggest failure?
God. So many things. I've learned not to make a movie if the circumstance is not right. Mm-hmm. I was forced into making a movie, I chose to make a movie where I knew it was super risky for various different reasons because of the producers and financiers that were involved. And I loved the material. And I was just like, okay, I'm going to go make this movie and screw it and everything will be okay. If you know at the beginning of a process, if you see red flags and you ignore them, which I did, ignore that at your peril, because things only ever get worse. And the other thing was like with a crew member on a movie, it's like, I knew I had a problem with a particular crew member. I didn't fire them because I thought, oh, this will be too much. You know, I really regretted that decision. As Alexander Payne always says, you know, fire quick, fire early. You know, as soon as you see a problem, that problem is not going to go away. It will magnify and amplify. So I guess my piece of advice is do not ignore red flags. and also, you know, having failures, though, is how you learn the lessons. You learn the lessons through having the failure. So even if you do have a failure, it's okay. It's all about, you know, that old thing is like if you get knocked down six times, the most important thing is you get up the seventh time. It doesn't really matter. You know, you just got to keep getting up. So that sort of not refusal to give in. You got to train yourself because often you're going to be on your own. You know, I mean, you mentioned Oliver Stone. I mean, the stuff that man has been through to get his films made, the determination, the kind of hardcore full force, like people telling him like, this is a crazy movie and you're anti-American and blah, blah, you know, but he knew, man, he knew what he needed to do and he just did it. And there's a certain relentlessness that I think is required. Like, just don't get caught up in other people's opinions because everyone is not going to see what you see and everyone's not necessarily going to believe in you. So I'm, you know, quite a sensitive person. I think most creative artists are. But you've got to have a sensitive side as it regards the work, but you've got to develop this warrior side. And I needed to develop that. And thankfully, I have had failures. And that helped me to develop those things, to be able to look failure in the face and go, okay, I'm going to avoid that now. So I'm not going to avoid that red flag. So when a crew member's doing this kind of shit early, get rid of them. Just deal with them. Just pull the Band-Aid now and deal with the pain. Don't put off dealing with situations. That was a big lesson that I needed to learn. And I learned it, but I learned it the hard way. And I think most people will learn their lessons the hard way, right? You know, it's very, what is it? What is that great thing? A wise man learns mistakes from others. A genius learns them from himself or something. I can't remember. But whatever it is, right? It's like you have to earn it yourself. You know, all the wisdom's out there. We know all the facts we need to know, but you got to, you know, track down your road on your own and just learn. And, you know, being a creative artist or a filmmaker, you know, it's a wonderful business. It's also a lonely business. You got to realize that. And, you know, family members and people are just not necessarily going to understand. And you have to be cool with that. But anyway, it is what it is. It's also the most wonderful thing in the world. If you do get through the battlefield and you do make a film and you do feel good about it, and you sit in an audience, you know, with people and you watch people listen and hear and respond to the ideas that you were trying to put into that movie. It's just so beautiful because you feel connected with complete strangers. You know, it's it's extraordinary. You know, it's like I was able to get an amazing print of E.T. and play it, you know, and I got this fantastic print and I was play it, you know, at my house with some filmmaker friends. And, you know, we were all in tears at the end. You know, it's like the ability that Spielberg has to reach people's hearts, you know, when he's working at his best, which is quite often, to be able to reach people's hearts and connect everyone around this notion, in that case, of sort of family and home. And, you know, that's a powerful spiritual skill to possess and to be able to deploy to bring people closer together. That's the whole idea of, for me, the stories and films, is to bring people closer together.
I have to ask you, did Stevens ever see Anvil?
I think he has. I didn't. I actually have to invite him to the premiere. I think
Please. It's
on. But I know that lots of people, I mean, some incredible people are already coming, some quite famous actors, actually. But yes, I think he may have. I'm not sure.
From what I understand from since talking to so many people who've worked with him, he's that kind of guy. He will watch
everything. He watches everything. Yeah.
Everything. And he'll write you a little note. He'll go.
And yeah, I got from Tom Hanks, I got an incredible note about Anvil. So,
oh, did you? That's amazing. And last question, sir. Three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, my God. Okay, Sweet Smell of Success, Alexander McKendrick, 1957. James Wong Howe, brilliant photography. Burt Lancaster, Tony Curtis. Ben Hecht, Clifford Odets screenplay. Unbelievable, the greatest of the New York movies. There's something so raw and visceral. And Burt Lancaster as J.J. Hunsaker is one of the great on-screen performances opposite Tony Curtis. And I love that movie. It's about power and moral corruption and desperation and, you know, New York. And it's just such a great film. So I'd recommend that. With Nail and I recommended before, which is my the great Bruce Robinson, you know, who was Academy Award nominated for Killing Fields, wrote and directed with Nail and I. Absolutely brilliant writer, brilliant filmmaker. I love that. And Chinatown, which is one of my favorite films of all time. Extraordinary Robert Towne script, Polanski at his best, Nicholson at his best. Just a brilliant film. You can go back. And those are movies that you can go back and watch multiple times. And each time you watch it, you discover something new or have a different experience, or you see it through the prism of whatever is going on in your life at that moment. That those are the great films, are the ones that you can watch when you're 10, 20, 30, 50, and they still work. And there's still something interesting, new, and exciting about them. And those are the classic films. So those are, like, off the top of my head. Sweet Smell, With Nail, and Chinatown are probably three of my favorite films. Also, I have to say, I love Remains of the Day. It's a brilliant, it's a beautiful script.
Ivory, yeah.
Most of which actually was written by Harold Pinter, though he refused to take credit for the screenplay. Emma Thompson at her best, Hopkins, I think, in his best performance, and James Ivory was the best Merchant Ivory film to me. So I would recommend people watch Remains of the Day. It's just, the script is structured in such a truly extraordinary, simple, brilliant, and effective way. It's such an emotional film because it's about unfulfilled yearning. Yearning is one of the most powerful human emotions for me. It's like, particularly when it's unfulfilled. In the case of a man, Stevens, played by Hopkins, who cannot express himself. He cannot say, "I love you." And there's such pathos in that and power, because love is there if only you'll have the courage to reach out and grab it. You know, I love that film. So that's one of my favorites. I have a print of that. I actually have two prints of Remains of the Day, which I watch pretty regularly.
And that is also a theme of Anvil. Are you brave enough to go out and grab what you want in life? And if they don't give it to you right away, are you willing to spend the next 30 years working in dive bars trying to figure it out until that 15-year-old roadie calls you up who made it in Hollywood and said, "Hey, you want to make a documentary?" And then 15 years later, call him up. "Hey, we're going to re-release
that." By the way, it's being re-released. I would also urge anyone who's interested in the Anvil story to look up one of the albums they did since the movie. The album is called Anvil Is Anvil. And Rob Reiner, the drummer, who's also a painter, as you'll see in the film, he actually drew an oil painting of an anvil staring at itself in a mirror. And the album's called Anvil Is Anvil. When I saw this cover, I called up Rob Reiner. I said, "Dude, how flipping high were you?" And he said, "Pretty high." He said, "Don't you think it's great?" And I said, "Actually, I do." It doesn't get any deeper than Anvil.
By the way, if you guys get a chance, the album covers for the 19 albums that they've done are brilliant.
They all feature an anvil. All the titles are, you know, sort of the alliterate: metal on metal, forged in fire, strength of steel, pound for pound, you know, whatever. It's madness. Go and see Anvil. But most importantly, can I suggest that if people want to see the movie, they should see the restored movie on the big screen. There's an interview with us afterwards and some bonus footage. And it's nationwide, September the 27th. Go to anvilthefilm.com to get tickets. And you'll see it's across the country and Canada. And I really hope that people go and see it and take their friends, because I think what you will have is a really good time.
And I don't even like heavy metal, and I love this film without question.
And it's also like Helen Mirren loves this movie. It's one of her favorite movies.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Of course it is.
You know, she's a little rock and roller, really. The reason I got the job directing Tony Hopkins in Hitchcock was because he loved Anvil. He and his wife have seen it three times. He loves Anvil. I think it just reaches you. So check it out. If you really hate the movie, you write to Alex. He'll send him. I will give you a money back guarantee.
Don't say that.
Send you the money. I just don't. If you really hate this movie, guess what? You deserve to have your money back. I will send it to you.
I appreciate that, and I'll put information about the giveaway for those two free tickets for the LA premiere on the what date is it again? September
22nd, and then nationwide in theaters the 27th. 5 days later.
My friend, it is a joy having you on the show. You're always welcome back whenever you want. It's just such a wonderful... I'm so glad that we're able to put this out into the world.
Thank you. I should say for your audience, thank you, Alex Ferrari, because you were like the little seed that planted the whole idea. When you said, you should bring this out into theaters again, I was like, what the hell are you talking about?
Are you high, Alex?
You suggested it, man. So I want to thank
it's
you.
All my fault. So if it wins, it's my fault. If it's a lose,
by the way, if you don't like the movie, write to Alex. He'll give you your money back. No.
Alex, oh, sorry, you're breaking up. This is a very bad connection now. All of a sudden, Sasha, my friend, it is a pleasure as always. Good luck to you, and please come back and let us know how it comes.
I will. I will let you know. I'll see you at the premiere. It'll just be me, you, and Anvil in a giant auditorium, but we'll have the time of our lives.
A pleasure, brother.
Okay. See you soon, guys. Bye. Thank you.
I want to thank Sasha so much, not only for coming back on the show, but also for bringing Anvil back into the world. I think it's a movie that we all need to see and the world needs to see. It's about not giving up on your dreams when, for God's sakes, you should have given up years ago. And that's what I love about this film. Now, if you want to get two free tickets to the LA premiere of Anvil, the story of Anvil, and it's just the tickets to the show. We're not paying for anything else. No hotels, no airplanes, nothing else. If you live in Los Angeles or you can get yourself to Los Angeles and you want these two free tickets to the premiere in LA with all the celebrities and everything else, all you need to do is email support@indiefilmhustle.com. And I want you to email a link, a video file, some sort of testimonial of what Indie Film Hustle and or Bulletproof Screenwriting has done for you on your creative journey. The one that has the best testimonial will win these two tickets. So all you got to do is email support@indiefilmhustle.com. And if we pick yours, we will use it on the main page of Indie Film Hustle as one of our testimonials. So again, support@indiefilmhustle.com. You can send us a Vimeo link. You can send us a G Drive link. Whatever it is, just send us 30 seconds to 60 seconds. That's all it needs to be. Nothing too crazy. And I'll be looking at them directly. My team will be looking at them. And we're going to choose the winner from there. All right, guys. Thank you so much for listening. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive, no matter what. And I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.